So we always have to start off talking about what we're talking about and what we're not talking about. So I know the title focuses on the digital world and emphasizes that we're not talking about filters. So just to explain what that means. So there's a lot to worry about as far as the digital world is concerned. We know that there's much that's not so appropriate and much that poses all kinds of challenges. I'm not going to focus on that so much. There's a lot of technology that's helpful with that. There's a lot to know about how to navigate that. So it was put, I didn't actually make up the title, but the title I know is intended to convey that that's not so much what we're going to focus on. We're interested more in when one is trying to raise a child, one is trying to raise children with values of, let's say, Hilchos Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, about how we relate to each other through the prism of the Torah perspective. What challenges are there that are inherent to the digital world, and how can we at least be aware of them? And this is, of course, not to ignore another subject that we won't really be able to talk about, which is the tremendous benefit to the digital world. We want to talk about navigating, so we could spend the whole day just talking about how to navigate through all the wonderful Torah opportunities that we find on the Torah world. Obviously, I'm partial to YU Torah, but there's so much more out there as well. And one could spend a very long time just trying to call attention and to give advice about what's best to look at, how to best utilize one's time, which now we could easily fill up many lifetimes with taking advantage of the Torah opportunities and the, in general, educational opportunities, and understanding how it's not even just about having access to lectures, but it's about a whole new mode of interaction which gives us opportunities that didn't even exist before. So we have fantastic opportunities as far as learning is concerned, and as far as chesed is concerned, as far as our ability to connect with each other when we need to connect with each other, and to be aware of the problems and the sufferings of others, and to do something about it in ways that weren't possible in earlier generations. So there's tremendous opportunities that come along with the digital world, and I'm certainly not here to come down and disparage and come out against the digital world, but rather just to kind of call our attention to what unique challenges there are, to some of the unique challenges, so that when we seek to educate our children, we can have this in mind and we can be aware of how we need to kind of provide a counterbalance. So one area of halacha which is very front and center when we talk about internet challenges is the issue of Lashon Hara. And I'm not going to speak exclusively about Lashon Hara in the next few minutes, but just to use this as a starting point, because it does illustrate some of the challenges. And there's one halacha which I think calls our attention to just how much things have changed. And it's an interesting point in and of itself. There is a surprising statement in the Talmud, has a lot to do with yesterday's parsha, but we won't spend time explaining how because it'll take away from the time that we have. But there's a striking statement in the Gemara which is hard to understand. It's very counterintuitive. That we know that if I were to come up to you and say, listen, I want to tell you something about Yehoshaphat. I'm assuming there's no Yehoshaphat in the room. I want to tell you something about Yehoshaphat. I think he's a jerk. Right? So that would probably be Lashon Hara. Right? But what if I would not only say it to you privately, but I would say it in front of this whole room? Would that make it better or would that make it worse? Presumably that would make it worse. You add more people, it becomes exponentially a bigger problem. And yet there is a hard to understand statement in the Talmud which disagrees. And you should know, the Chafetz Chaim agrees with you. The Chafetz Chaim writes that if you speak to one person it's bad, and to many people it's logically worse. And yet, the Gemara has a statement that something that's said in public, I have to translate it vaguely because it's hard to know exactly how to translate it, but something that's said in front of three, which is a way of saying that it is public or will be public, less behu mishum lishnabisha, it's not subject to Lashon Hara. Somehow, if it's out there in public, that's better. To tweak it a little bit more, let's say, and this is where this comes into discussion of yesterday's parsha, you can ask me afterwards exactly how, but what if it's not necessarily that there are a lot of people in the room, but there's one person specifically added to the room. And that one person is Yehoshaphat himself, who I'm talking about. Does that make it better or does that make it worse? I would think that also makes it worse. Not only am I speaking badly about him, but I'm embarrassing him too. So I would think that would make it worse. And the Chafetz Chaim, once again, would agree. The Chafetz Chaim writes, to speak about somebody is a problem, is a transgression. And to do so when the person's there, you're adding on humiliation. It's certainly worse. And yet, once again, there's another baffling statement in the Talmud. It's a question how to interpret it. It says if the person is present, it's called ape mara, if the person you're talking about is there, less behum is shumlush nabisha, there's no lashon hara. So there's a lot to talk about, way more than the time we have, about how to interpret these two baffling statements. But I want to focus just on one comment that you find in Tosfos on the side of the page of the Talmud, which I think gives us a big insight into how our culture has shifted. Tosfos suggests that when the Talmud says it's better if you're in public, or it's better if the person you're talking about is there, we're not talking about your normal garden variety lashon hara where you're just disparaging someone. Talking about a very narrow situation. You are saying something which really you mean positively, but it's a little ambiguous. So it could come across positively or negatively. So then maybe you really shouldn't say it, because if there's a chance it's going to come across the wrong way. So then maybe you shouldn't be saying such a thing. So Tosfos says that's true. Unless, if it's said in public, or it's said and the person is present, so then your audience can assume that you probably mean it the positive way. And you can be safe in thinking that they'll take it that way. If you take somebody into a corner privately and tell them this, who knows how they'll interpret. But saying it in public, saying it in front of the person, it must be you meant it nicely. So if I say to you in the corner, Yehoshaphat, you can always count on him. So you don't know if I mean you can always count on him, he's reliable, or you can always count on him to mess up. You don't know what I mean. But if I get up at the shul dinner and Yehoshaphat is sitting right here in the front, and I say, Yehoshaphat, you can always count on him. So then it's safe to assume that I mean it the positive way. So think about this for a second. Here, Tosfos, let's say, it's written 900 years ago. Tosfos is saying that even though we always have a tendency to occasionally speak nastily about each other, and all of us say things from time to time that are not so nice, but if we're speaking in public, if a lot of people can hear us, or if the person we're talking about is there, then we can always assume that you must mean it nicely. You must not be seeking to say something hurtful or disparaging. So that's the assumption several hundred years ago. So let me ask you, today, in 2016, where we communicate over the World Wide Web, which is not Ape Tzlasa, which means in front of three, but it's Ape 7 billion, give or take. And presumably that includes the person you're speaking about. Does this assumption still hold true? Is it still the case that, well, in that case, you probably are being nice. You're probably not going to say something hurtful. So that's a reality that's shifted. That we have a different culture today than we had once upon a time. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean, okay, we have to opt out and throw away all our devices. I have one over here, I have one over there, I'm plugged in 24/6. I'm not here to say, throw it all out the window. But it's something to think about. It's something to be aware of, especially as we try to educate our children to be decent, nice, respectful people who uphold the values of our halachic system, particularly here in the realm of interpersonal relations. It's something to be aware of, something to question whether our atmosphere has shifted. And it's been documented extensively in the psychological literature that there is a reality that's been termed the online disinhibition effect. That when people communicate in front of a computer screen, let's say in their pajamas in their mother's basement, so they don't have the face-to-face interaction that they otherwise would have had. And that creates a reality of disinhibition, meaning that whatever would put a check on their behavior, whatever would make them think twice before saying something, isn't fully there. And that's before you even come on to anonymity. We're not necessarily assuming that the person is anonymous. When you have anonymity, there's no question that that adds a whole level of danger to the mix. And there's a lot to talk about that as far as if we're concerned about behavior. So we certainly have to wonder, If we want people to behave properly, how likely is it that they're going to behave properly if they feel like no one can see them? If no one knows who they are when they're doing what they're doing? And this is something which is obviously not a new question. It's been dealt with for many centuries. It was dealt with by Plato in his Republic, where he talked about the question of what if there was hypothetically a ring that somebody could wear and they would be invisible. And nobody would see who they are when they're doing whatever they're doing. So can we assume that people will still act in a moral fashion if they're not able to be perceived? So one would like to think idealistically that yes, we do things that are right because they're right, and we avoid things that are wrong because they're wrong. But we know that the reality is more to it. And if, especially at the teenage level, when we don't have fully formed sense of responsibility, so is it reasonable to assume that the behavior is going to be what we want it to be when there is anonymity? So that's a very serious question, which there's a lot to talk about. And it's fascinating that anonymity, you assume the biggest issue is the sense of impunity, the idea that you can't be punished for what you're doing because nobody can connect it to you. But it's more than that. It's a psychological effect that's more subtle than that. There's a book called Sidetracked by a professor named Francesca Gino, where she noted a study that people tend to take more liberties, let's say cheating on a test or other types of misbehavior, when, not that they're totally isolated from others, but even if the lighting in the room is darker. That the more you feel a little bit like you're not being watched, it's a subtle psychological effect that reduces your sense of responsibility. So certainly it's true if you know people can't see you, but even when people really can see you, but you're a little bit less connected to that, you have a feeling that you're a little bit less visible to others, that has a demonstrable effect on how you behave, and that's a serious consideration. And this also, again, is not only about impunity, but it's the reality that people feel that they can act in a way that's different from how they really see themselves normally. That they don't feel like this is really them. They can't be identified. It's not just that they can't be punished, but that they don't have to uphold their own standards even between them and themselves, because this isn't really them acting. They act when they are identifiable. When they're not identifiable, so this isn't your personality, and you're not even, as far as your own reckoning is concerned, responsible for your behavior in the same way. And there is a phenomenon which has also been documented called de-individuation, that when you feel like you're not connected to an identity that's your own, but that you're part of a faceless mass. This is something that was documented by Dr. Philip Zimbardo, who's well known for the Stanford Prison Experiment, where people were put in roles where they were prisoners or jailers, and they kind of lost all connection to the type of behavior they normally would expect of themselves. So when you're in this context where your identity is downplayed, so together with that, you tend to have less of a sense of responsibility. And that's also part of it. We don't have to fully come on to, this idea of not being punishable, of impunity, even just having a lowered sense of being watched by anyone else and having an environment around you which downplays your independent identity has this effect on how you behave, and that's something that's a serious consideration. So it's not just about Lashon Hara then, it's not just about that one particular transgression, but there are all kinds of other values about how we relate to each other that are also affected by this. So for example, we have a very serious Torah prohibition called Onas Dvarim, that if one says something that imposes pain on somebody else, not that you're talking about somebody else necessarily, but even just communicating to somebody else, the way you say it and the way you come across is very much guided by Torah prohibitions. We have this idea, we read about it in the Torah a few weeks ago, lo sonu, that we're not allowed to be oppressive in our behavior, and therefore our connectedness to how we're coming across and to how we're communicating becomes a matter of tremendous halachic concern. And you don't have to do any fancy studies to see this. You can look, if you look, for example, at any news site, let's say if Chas V'Shalom, unfortunately happens too often, if Chas V'Shalom is a tragedy, so you see a news site that will report it, and you look at the comments that are on the site, and there are people, even anonymous and non-anonymous, who are saying things that they would never say if they went to a shiva and they were confronting an individual. They wouldn't say this to their face. And yet, it's very likely that the same people who would have been hearing it there are reading it here and are seeing these same comments, and there's this sense of complete disconnectedness from this, and that's a very problematic thing. So that comes along certainly with anonymity, but even without anonymity, there's a decreased sense of self and a decreased sense of responsibility, which is something that you have to be very concerned about. And it goes in two directions, because you're less connected to yourself, but you're less connected to others. This is something which has also been tremendously documented, that there is a decreased sense of empathy when interacting in this non-face-to-face manner, and it doesn't end there, but that it extends to all of your other interactions, even when you are dealing face-to-face. Susan Cain, in her book Quiet, quotes a study. I don't know exactly how you evaluate this, but she quoted a study from the University of Michigan that college students today are 40% less empathetic than they were several years ago. And they attribute that to a number of factors, but one of the factors they attribute it to is the fact that they interact mostly in a social and digital environment, and that changes how we relate to it, how we relate to each other. And we talk about the prohibition of onas devarim. If you want to analyze it halachically, if you want to look at the current that runs through all the different examples that you find in the Talmud, the Mishnah gives a whole list. You look other places in Shas, you find a few other items to add to the list. There are different ways in which the Talmud says one violates onas devarim, and one does things that cause emotional pain to others. And the commentaries try to figure out what's the dominant theme, what's the shared element among the examples. So many suggest that it has to do with how you relate to others. It's not necessarily even about the effect so much. The effect comes out of it, but it comes from an attitude, a lack, essentially, of empathy, of seeing others as worthy of respect the same way you see yourself, of connecting to their pain. It simply all revolves around the sense of empathy. So to whatever extent empathy is reduced, so that would be something that we would need to be tremendously concerned about. And this translates into other halakhic values, which also emanate from a concern for empathy. We know that after one has inflicted emotional pain on somebody else, so the Mishnah tells us in Seches Yuma and Seches Bava Kamma, Daf Yomi in a few weeks, that we have an obligation to ask for forgiveness. We have to request forgiveness, and the Mishnah has in Yuma a different language, Yufais. You have to appease the other party, which is important language because, as the commentaries explain, it doesn't just mean that you say, I'm sorry, do forgive me, but it has to actually be a process of making the person feel better. And it's a question, again, whether we're as connected to that as we once were. So Sherry Turkel has written a lot about this field. She has a book called Alone Together. She has many books about this. So in the book Alone Together, she talks about interviews that were done with high school girls, which directly connects to this point, that they say that when they offend each other, as I guess occasionally happens, so afterwards, when they want to apologize or they want to get an apology, so the apology will come through a text message. And they feel that they're not really getting the apology. The person who's sending the text thinks they've done what they have to, but the person who's receiving it, and it's very fascinating to read these interviews because it correlates to a lot that you find in the halachic literature about the obligation of apology. There's supposed to be a sense of reconnecting the relationship, of saying essentially, empathetically, that I heard your feelings, but I recognize that you are hurting, and I'm sorry for that, and I want to restore the relationship. And these high school girls are commenting, they don't feel that that's really happening when they're getting these text messages. And that's one more aspect of how the types of people that we're trying to raise may be affected both on the receiving end and on the giving end because of the format in which they're interacting. And that's also a very striking point to be aware of. And we find together with this that it's not just that the person is not really standing with you and feeling your pain when they issue their apology, but you know, this is something which was discussed many centuries ago. I remember a few years ago, before it was even so ubiquitous, that one of the Jewish weekly papers had on the front page around Yom Kippur time, wants to express the news in a current way, so it says, can you ask for forgiveness through email? So it's not really a new question. This is a question that was discussed centuries earlier in terms of even just sending letters or sending emissaries when you send somebody else, an intermediary, instead of yourself. Does that reduce the impact that the apology is meant to be had? So the question is exacerbated in this environment, but it's one that the Poskim dealt with a long time ago. And that's a question that we really have to ask. Are we really getting what we need out of the relationships? And the line that Shari Turkel quotes there is that we get used to getting less, meaning getting less out of our human interactions, and that's a significant problem. And in terms of getting less in the sense of understanding, so one of the very serious considerations that we have to ask about is what about tone? Because such a crucial part of how we have to interact with each other is not just the words, but it's also the tone, and it's also the message that's conveyed through other non-verbal forms. And studies, again, I don't know exactly how they calculate this, but there's a book John Friedman wrote called Tyranny of Email, where the Tyranny of Email, where he documents this, that they say 50% of the time in a text message communication, people misunderstand the tone. They don't know whether something is sarcastic or whether something is serious, whether something is sympathetic or something is gloating, and that's a pretty high percentage. And there's a book that came out since then called Mindwise by Nicholas Epley, where he adds to this that it's not just that 50% misunderstand the tone, but those same people, whether they're the ones sending or the ones receiving, they're 100% sure they got it right. The one who's sending is 100% sure that he conveyed it exactly as it's meant to be conveyed, and the one who read it is 100% sure that he understood it the way it's meant to be understood. And each one, he writes, each one doesn't know how the other one could be so stupid. Each one doesn't know how the other one couldn't get it. So that's a serious problem that we have in our communications. So these are issues in halacha that are affected by how we're interacting, and there are many others, and we're going to be affected by running out of time in a minute, but just to mention one or two others, it's interesting also, if you go back to Lashon Hara for a moment, so there is something called Avak Lashon Hara, and Avak Lashon Hara means that, after discussion what exactly it means, but it sounds like it means, at least according to some of the Rishonim, is that I'm not only responsible for what I say, I'm responsible also for what I provoke. So, for example, there's this surprising statement in the Talmud. You think Lashon Hara, by definition, means bad. But Lashon Hara could also be good. If you say something good about someone, so the Talmud says it's also problematic. And some of the Rishonim explain that the issue is that you're going to say something good, and your friend who's listening is going to say, oh, you think he's so good? Let me tell you stories. Let me tell you why he's not. And you're going to have a rebuttal. You're going to have a negative statement that you're apparently responsible for, even though you were saying the opposite, but you're bringing that statement into the world. So that was a concern once upon a time, but you could say once upon a time, still there are environments where I could be pretty confident. I'm talking to two or three friends who are nice people, and we're all friends with the person we're talking about, so I could be probably reasonably confident I say something positive about that other party, that the people I'm talking to will take it the way it's meant to, or they're not going to necessarily come to challenge it. There are environments in which I could feel safe in such a comment. Nowadays, you say something online, I can tell you there's nobody out there who's so powerful, there's nobody who's so uncomplicated that there isn't somebody somewhere in the World Wide Web who's going to say, you think that person is great, I could tell you why they're not. I could tell you all kinds of stories. So we have a much more complicated environment if we're dealing with an open setting where who knows what could happen. And that's something which, you might be surprised to see, was dealt with by Rabbeinu Yonah several centuries ago, long before there was an internet. The problem, and maybe the answer also, was discussed by Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah writes that this problem of avak lashon hara, of provoking comments that are going to go in a different direction, so he writes, as we just described, that that problem is exacerbated in a larger setting. The more people there are in the conversation, the greater the likelihood that there's somebody who might come and challenge it. So in a very basic way, he's describing what would become a much greater problem many centuries later, but perhaps he's also addressing the problem a little bit. He says a way to try to counterbalance that is if you create an environment where it's clear that that's not going to be welcome, that whoever is going to try to pipe up and talk in a different way, they are not going to find acceptance within your social circle, so that will hopefully counterbalance it a little bit. So that's also true in the online environments that we take part in and that we participate in, that perhaps there are ways in which we can set a tone that can hopefully counterbalance that. But again, getting the right tone is a big challenge, and that's a part of the responsibility that we have as parents and as teachers to try to be aware of these issues and to where there are particular challenges. And of course, because all of this leads to a problem that we're very concerned about nowadays, is a problem of cyberbullying, that people harass each other over the internet or over text messages or over any type of digital communication. And we don't want our children to be on either side of that. We don't want our children to be perpetrating that, and we don't want our children to be receiving that. They're both tremendous problems in their own way. So because this environment does, as we've described, contribute to that possibility in ways that were not previously possible, so this is also something that we have to be aware of, especially because the point that we mentioned a moment ago about misreading tone is very significant, because you could have situations, which people write about, where somebody essentially is bullying somebody else and they don't even mean to be, that they're talking in a certain way that they think they're just kind of joking around in a way that would be taken as joking around, but because they're not sensitive to how their tone is coming across, in a way that perhaps face-to-face they would have been able to be more sensitive, so then they're ending up perpetrating behavior that they wouldn't have otherwise, and they don't even think they're doing now. And all of that is something that we have to be very sensitive to. And since we are just about out of time, one of the major points, just not to forget about because it's such a crucial, obvious element, is the element of privacy. The privacy, whether we mean tznius in the more limited sense that we sometimes talk about, or even just the reality of privacy on an emotional level, on a family level, the tremendous premium that the halacha and psychological health places on having a sense of privacy. Clearly, there's been a tremendous breach as far as how that's related to nowadays. There's an environment that encourages much more self-exposure and much more self-revelation. And that's something which, you know, we talk about in our earlier literature, that privacy, again, even in addition to the more talked-about aspects of tznius and those that focus on the body and the like, but even just on an emotional level, we have a tremendous emphasis and value placed on privacy, and that's also greatly challenged by the environment in which we find ourselves. So because I have to wrap up, so I'll just mention that again, none of this is coming to say that the internet is something that we want to throw out the window, but it's saying that when we seek to raise children who are careful about Lashon Hara, careful about Anos Devarim, careful about patching up their relationships properly when there's been some kind of a breach, careful about not being involved in harassing others, and careful about not finding themselves in a situation where they are degraded or humiliated or embarrassed or hurt in any other way. All of these are aspects that we have to be aware of and sensitive to, and try to find as many ways as possible in the environment that we create, in the days that we plan, in the conversations that we have, to be aware of these and to try to offset them as much as possible. Thank you very much for your time. Hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Only good things.